here is that interview. Conrad Vispo and Dylan Sapowski from the Hawthorne Valley Farmscape Ecology Program, musician Julia Meyer and Bug Music author David Rothenberg, about the sounds of insects on local farms.
All right, I'm Tom Rowe here in the WGXC Acre Studio, and the studio is full today. We have a bunch of people who are working on a sound project at Hawthorne Valley?
Out of Hawthorne Valley.
We have Conrad from left to right on you, if you're listening on the radio. Conrad Vispo, Julia Meyer, Dylan Sipkowski, and David Rothenberg. Why don't we go around and you can each tell what your part of this project is. And Conrad, I guess you should start.
Yeah, so this project originated. We were doing some work in orchards and hadn't been planning to do this, but got into it. And so I started to do it. And then Dylan was our field tech and he got into helping us. And that's where it started.
Yeah, so like Conrad said, I'm the technician for the Farmscape Ecology Program. And I wasn't actually present for the collection of the data in the field, but I was there analyzing the data at the computer, looking at sonograms and identifying the different insects in those recordings.
I'm Julia. I'm an intern at Hawthorne Valley, and I'm just here to listen and learn more about the project.
I don't know anything about the project, except what I've read online and the PowerPoint-type slides. And you know, I wrote a book called Bug Music about insect sound and music, so I'm very interested in anyone who's trying to make sense of the combined overlapping ecological sounds of bugs in the environment and collecting data about this and trying to make sense of it. In my next book, there's a whole chapter on big data analysis of natural sounds, and this project seems to fit into that category. So
you have a book called Bug Music out, and
one's already out.
Yeah, what is the new book called?
Nightingales in Berlin.
Nightingales in Berlin,
which it's about playing music with nightingales in Berlin. But there's one chapter I talk about what's happening in soundscape studies. We can now analyze so much data, we can look at whole sounds, one place, an entire year in one image, and listening to insect sounds in and around the Hudson Valley is a great test case to try out this approach.
And Conrad, you collected the data at Hawthorne Valley or else?
No, so this was a project we were looking at how orchards, seven different orchards around the Hudson Valley, from up in Saratoga County to down southern Dutchess County, and in between, in over in Ulster County. And trying to look at how insects were flowing across the landscape. And we were doing insect trapping and observations and things like that. And then one of the other groups we were trying to look at was bats. And one of the ways you look at bats is to make recordings. And I was setting up my bat equipment, and there was a lot of what I thought was interference. And it wasn't interference, it was all the bugs calling. And so that led to trying to map the insects and actually try to look at visually where they were laid out on the landscape.
And I guess the bats and the insects are intrinsically linked, since the bats feed off the insects, right?
Yeah, although not necessarily these insects. They're linked in a way, but not, I don't know to what degree, maybe David knows more, but I don't know to what degree these particular insects would be interacting acoustically with the bats.
What kind of insects are mostly in the Hudson Valley?
Well, ones that we were looking at,
yeah.
There's a variety of crickets and grasshoppers and tree crickets and bush crickets and katydids. Those are mainly, it's a group called the Orthoptera, and that's what we were mainly recording.
And you did this research recently, or was it last summer? Like the cicadas were around.
It was actually a couple of summers, it must have been two summers ago that we did it. And then we've done, what was interesting is we were trying to do it, we were doing it in collaboration with the different orchardists. And when we did the sound, then at the end of the year, we presented to them the various results we had. And some of those were bar graphs of, you know, the number of insects in this habitat or that habitat. And then some of them were the sound maps. And they just really connected to those. And they wanted to share those with their customers. And so that got us into thinking about these as a way of, as a nice way of communicating what was happening in the landscape that didn't need a whole lot of explanation.
What do you mean by a sound map?
So this is, no, this is where radio fails us.
Maybe. Oh, it's a piece of paper. It's not something you can hear. Well, you can hear that. You can hear the pieces of paper.
Right, I'll wrinkle them close to the microphone. So a sound map, basically, what we do is we go out into a particular landscape, and we set up a grid of recordings. And in this case, this was our first attempt at doing this at a large scale. We walked that grid. So we had just one single handheld microphone, and we'd walk to a point, we'd record for, I forget what it was, 10, 20 seconds, something like that, and then we'd go on to the next point, and the next point, and the next point. And so then we would form this grid of recordings. And then at each of those points, we looked at the power of sound at a particular frequency, trying to choose a frequency that corresponded to one of these insects.
So you wanted to eliminate the man-made noises, the planes overhead and the trains.
Well, I was trying to focus on what one species was telling us, in a way. And there's lots of, as David knows, there's a whole range of them out there. And so when you look at a sonogram, really you see that most of the time there's a variety of different organisms calling at the same time. And so if you tried to make a map of all those sounds at once, it might get kind of confusing. And so we were trying to pick out, our goal was to say, okay, on this grid of ours across the landscape, which creatures were where on that landscape? And so we, at each of those points, we would pick a particular frequency that represented a certain species and say, okay, what was the power of the sound at that frequency? And then we did a map, essentially like a heat map, where heat corresponded to the power of the sound at that. And so you get, this is one of the properties that we were looking at, and these are just two different insects, so which you can end up, and you can color this any way you want, but you end up with a map that kind of looks like an ink blot test in various colors. But what that shows you, and you overlay it on an aerial photograph, you can see where on the landscape these sounds were most powerful. And it's interesting to contrast the different species, and you realize... certain species were mainly found around the edges. Certain species were mainly found where the tall grasses were. Certain species were in the brush. And so, to me, it's a way of being able to visualize those patterns that, at least with my ears, I'm not so good at picking up.
Have scientists previously sort of pinpointed, without sound, that katydids are in tall grasses, or, I'm not sure if that's the truth, but...
Yeah, to a certain extent. And some people have used sound. So this is definitely not the first time that people have tried to use sound to understand the distribution of these species.
But it seems to me scientists are studying sound of insects and other creatures more these days than in the past.
David would better answer that than I am.
So one question I'd ask you is whether you've published this research or thought about publishing it.
Well, at this point, Dylan, why don't you do it? So Dylan presented this talk at the Northeast Natural History Conference, and that's the degree to which it has been published so far, is just as a scientific presentation.
Because this is a growing field of soundscape ecology, and there's a new journal just starting this month, which I am on the board for some reason, even though I'm not a scientist, called Acoustic Ecology, I believe. And there's a handful of researchers around the world just doing this kind of work. Probably the leading figures is Italian scientist Almo Farina, who wrote this book, Principles of Soundscape Ecology. And he and his students have done a whole series of studies like this, looking at insects and birds over grids like this. And, really trying to push this idea, this kind of soundscape research that can only be done now when it's so easy to collect all this data and analyze it. Until recently, it was hard to make sense of huge amounts of sonic data, like doing the kind of thing you did every day for, a year or something. People would say, what could we possibly do with that information? Now you can analyze it. And this is a growing field. So they've been able to look at sort of vast data, soundscape ecology, and draw various conclusions.
So we don't have kind of historical data yet, but we have very recent data, I guess, on sound.
People have some historical data, but not the scale, because it used to be too expensive to have that much information. And the idea of looking at a whole place, the most interesting change is the idea, instead of studying just one species, to look at how these species interact and be able to study how as different species listen to each other, you know, which is actually more prevalent in insects than in birds. Like, you could easily find in your, what you've already collected, that certain, you know, the crickets, who don't actually think that much, they don't have very big brains compared to, say, birds, you know, they listen to each other from one species to another probably more than birds do.
There's interspecies communication?
Absolutely. Because there's a sonic response, like cicadas, like lawnmowers. You know, they hear the lawnmower, the cicada will sing, one cricket hears this sound, they sort of respond like little machines, you know, and they kind of, this is why this music is formed from all these critters, that's kind of, no one's really in charge. That's why it sounds so interesting to us. And that now we can collect all this data, you can really like, wow, look, you know, look at these two species, how they overlap. Let's listen to it. You hear them relating to each other.
And why were the, you said the farmers were really interested in these sound maps. Why were the farmers interested?
Because I think the farms we were working on a lot had an ecological bent. And so it was a way of illustrating the life on their farms. And people could walk out in some of these where you pick and they would hear the insects. But until you kind of register them in another way, you're not as conscious of them often. And I think some people are a lot more auditory than others. But this was just one way of bringing in the customers to... customers, not necessarily that they would buy more, but just to be have them more involved and connected with the farm. And this was one way of looking at the farm in a different way, or the orchard in a different way.
Dylan, are you new to this sort of research?
I started as on with Farmscape as an internship, as an intern, and then that turned into a position as a technician. And while I studied environmental studies in college and worked with fish and mammals, I didn't do much work with insects, so it's pretty new to me.
I asked because I was wondering, what was the most surprising thing you learned have learned so far through this?
Yeah, I mean, one really neat thing I thought was just being able to identify, I mean, and this is simple, but just being able to identify a species of singing insect from a sonogram, looking at the sonogram and seeing what frequency is that insect singing at, and what pattern, how is that insect singing, and then being able to ID that, looking at resources. There's a book we used a lot. It's by Lang Elliott and Will Hirschberger. The Songs of Insects.
Classic.
That was a great resource because it shows you how to ID these insects from the noises they make, but you need a sonogram to do that. So that was just really, really neat. I'm so used to IDing things by looking at them, but by being able to ID something to species by listening to it was neat.
It's so interesting that sound can be sometimes clearer to us when we see it, as opposed to listening to it, because the sounds, you know, you can learn to distinguish them, but you see the differences more readily. But now you can make sonograms live on your phone. You just turn on some sonogram app and have it right out there. It's making them as you hear it, which was this technique that no one had until recently, like with such ease.
And I'm guessing, maybe you can correct me, that the term "songs of insects" is a human thing. Are insects actually singing, or what is the, why are they making these noises? Are they to attract predators to eat them, or what is it?
We don't know if the insects call what they're doing songs or music, because we're not sure how they reflect on their activities. I think most human languages and societies have called these things songs because they recognize that they have these musical qualities. At least that's what I've always argued in my various books on this, because like the quality of these sounds is much more like music than like language, in that you have, whether it's a bird or a bug, you have these sort of simple things repeated over and over and over again. You know, often, not always, but often the males are making these sounds to attract females. They're not using their mouth to do it, but they're rubbing their legs together, or wings, or cicadas, or vibrating their abdomen, you know. And they make these sounds, you know, to attract attention.
What is their intention? To attract attention to...
Yeah, to attract a mate, usually, in a lot of these things. But if you look at, like, tree hoppers that vibrate the trees they walk on, the males and females are communicating to each other, surprisingly complicated for, like, a bug that's really tiny. And so it's often more nuanced than the standard view. But, you know, it's like a song. It's like this human music has the same function, but just talking about the function doesn't explain everything. The thing that's cool about insects is they make this music together where each one is not aware of the whole plan. Like Katie did. They just know a little bit, and all together they make this whole musical composition that people have generally appreciated for centuries.
And I guess really there it almost works as an orchestra with the different insects making noises simultaneously.
Yeah, right? And as I said before, they tend to listen to one another, one species to another, more than birds are thought to do. But then again, that's also something people are just starting to study, like what goes on at the dawn chorus. We actually have no official scientific explanation for why birds sing at dawn. Like, we have no idea, despite years of paying attention to it. Most of these different hypotheses can't really be proven. People are like, do they do it? One, I mean, my favorite hypothesis is they just get up and say, hey, I'm still here, I'm alive. That's a serious hypothesis. A more new agey hypothesis is the birds have to sing to make the plants grow. There isn't much scientific proof of that, but that's a cool idea. Another pragmatic view is that, you know, it's too early to go get any food, so let's just sing now. It's a good time to sing because we have to divide up the day rationally, and later we'll be going to get things to eat. That's also just somebody's idea. We don't really know. And how can we not know that? People are asking questions for centuries and investigating, and there's so much we just don't know, which I find comforting somehow.
Comforting?
Absolutely.
You like the unknown part of it.
Of course, yeah. Because, like, you know, we spend so much time claiming we know stuff. And, like, this basic phenomenon around us we can't really explain, and yet we witness them.
Conrad, why did you get interested in insects and insect sounds, I guess, originally?
I did not study entomology. I didn't study insects. I studied wildlife ecology. But I've always been interested in patterns. And so initial work was, where do you find certain small mammals? How are they distributed across the landscape? And then did some work with birds, a particular kind of bird, and where did they live during the winter? What were their patterns? And then got into looking at sort of plant distributions. And so really came to insects as another color on the landscape, another way of looking at life's patterns on the landscape. And in agricultural settings, it's important because they're often either pests or beneficials. And so it was a good way for me to combine those interests in kind of the ecology of patterns and the ecology of agriculture.
I usually think of farmers trying to get rid of insects, right?
I mean, definitely there are pests, insects, there's no doubt about that. But I think more and more insects are being recognized as beneficials. And it's not just the pollinators. It's also the ones that are weed seed predators. There are ones that are very important are the parasitic wasps that control a lot of the caterpillars in agricultural situations. So there's really a whole diversity of insects out there that are probably helping farmers. And so it's trying to find how do you tweak it so that you're getting more of the beneficial and less of the detrimental effects.
So farmers can actually use some of this data to figure out how to help the useful instead of putting on pesticides?
Well, that would be nice. Now, many of these
I'm making
insects,
a leap there, it sounds like.
A leap, yeah. Because many of these singing insects are not the ones we were looking at, are not directly interacting with them, either positively or negatively. I think probably a lot of farmers enjoy the sounds, and some of the grasshoppers might, or katydids might eat some of the plants, but it's not a big effect. So I think if there is a connection, it's going to be more indirect. For example, one of the things we've been looking at is how does a diverse landscape with lots of wildflowers, for example, how does that support wasps, which are very directly linked, or bees, for that matter. Or in the case, Julia's been studying spiders, and they're also beneficial because they're often pest predators. So how does a diverse landscape support these organisms? And then perhaps that's also a noisier landscape. And so perhaps this mapping can lead us there, but we haven't been able to make that connection yet.
It's sort of more of a one piece in a lot of different puzzles.
Well, and another part of our question is not just, okay, how can insects help people? Yeah, we're people, that's important. But it's also how can we support or conserve insects? And so trying to look at these farms at the same time from the perspective of their role in nature conservation. And so in that case, these insects are part of the life that's out there. And understanding where they are in the landscape and what supports them, then if it's something that the farmers can incorporate, then they are helping life, and maybe it helps their production, maybe it doesn't. That remains to be seen.
And I guess there aren't, or David, we talked about this a little before, there are not as many long-term studies about sound to know about the larger changes, I guess.
People are starting to do them. You know, they're starting to realize that it's worth collecting all this information over a long period of time.
So we may eventually know, if you study a ecological area that goes through some dying process, how the sound affected that, or what that the sound might predict future problems or something.
Yeah, there's people collecting that kind of information and trying to investigate those conclusions. Like, you know, part of Almo Farina's research is talking about, you know, the kind of acoustic complexity of environments, the acoustic complexity index. And that's one of like five different indices that these acoustic scientists have come up with to know that. And you know, Farina tries to argue that a healthy ecosystem kind of sounds better in a more complex way, and the unhealthy ones dominated by human sounds, it's just like a thrum of one kind of noise. And you know, like, they're not complex in a good way. There's just like, you just hear this machine all the time, you're next to the highway, and that's like acoustically simple, where it's complex, is where you have the insects and the birds and all together. But
so,
there are those
a
that
more
say,
complex, like a fully yeah. orchestrated uh-huh. sound is a sign of a healthy.
That's what he says. But there's others who say, like, look, you're just being ideological here. Like, isn't a complex soundscape, like, you know, Brooklyn, Manhattan, noises, is birds and bats and screeching buses with their ultrasonic sounds mixed together with people and machines and everything. Isn't that really complexity? Like, come on, nature has complexity, but can you actually say that human sonic landscapes are not complex? You just don't want to like them because you're saying they're not ecologically cool. But
Brooklyn has a complex sound.
Anywhere, yeah, I'm just saying Brooklyn. Yeah. It's a kind of urban place people like rather than talking about
Milwaukee.
Milwaukee, I'm sure, has a beautifully complex soundscape. But you know, it's interesting to look at these things, and because a lot of ecological, you know, thinking and science is to try and people want to make a point that there's something good and valuable about nature, and they connect it with data and science, and then. But sometimes it's all to push a particular point of view, which can be one way or another, you know.
A lot of scientists come into this with some preconceived notions
they're not supposed to, because it's supposed to be objective. They're supposed to clear their preconceptions.
But it's hard.
Sometimes. It's hard in any sense, yeah. And so,
Are there a lot of insect sounds, you know, like bats you can't hear with your human ears? Are there insects that make sounds that you can't hear with your human ears?
I don't know.
Yeah, absolutely.
Other frequencies you have...
Of course, there's things that we don't hear. And what's fascinating is insects make a lot of sounds they can't hear. So why are they making them? Is it just an accident, or are they for us?
They can't hear themselves.
They're making sounds that we hear, but it's not what they hear, yeah.
They could be making them to predators or to...
Who knows?
Yeah.
Yeah, like there's so many examples of that. That they're you know, does that mean they're making them for predators, or is it just an inadvertent consequence of...
And you mentioned before there's some people suggesting that the insects may make the sound to help the plants grow. Or help. Is there science about that yet? Or
no, that's the anti-scientific view, or it's a kind of spiritual science view. But, you know, it doesn't mean it's not correct.
Yeah, there's, like, aren't there some people that think middle C, the human body
things
resonates
like that.
In middle C?
Like, those things might be true, yeah.
And it's just something we don't know enough about yet.
Yeah, and it's also, yeah. Who knows, you know, there's a lot of things science is never going to answer. They don't ask the right questions, or they don't, you know, they don't think in certain ways. It doesn't mean they're not there. Science can only figure certain kinds of things out, other things it doesn't dare deal with.
What were you most surprised about in all this, Conrad?
I think it was just to me, being able to see those, just going back to being able to see those patterns again. So I've done like tree maps, and that always, then it becomes a way for me to walk through the forest and say, oh yeah, I realize when I walk through these parts, yes, I usually do see them, sugar maples down where it's a bit lower than where I'm seeing these scarlet oak or what have you. And so what's always fun for me is this kind of going back and forth between looking at it very technically and then experiencing it again, and how you learn from going back and forth between those. And so I think I still have a long, long way to go with the insects, because I've not actually done a lot of this. But I just realized that I'm being more aware. Ah, yes, right, when I'm standing beside pines, I'm hearing a certain kind of tree cricket that I'm not hearing when I'm someplace else. And so just that broadening one's perspective, I think, has been a surprise to me. And I was just going to add one thing in relationship to what you were saying about the ways of assessing the kind of coming up with an index of the complexity of the sound environment. One project we've been talking about a little bit, and it may or may not get off the ground, is that there is a project under the University of New Hampshire where they're planning to put up these weather stations on various farms and look at quality of the soil and things like that. And there's a man named Doran Cox who's also involved in that. And he was looking at, he set up a PhenoCam, which is a camera that takes pictures periodically and looks at how the landscape changes. And so I said, well, why don't we put up a microphone? Why don't we also try on each of these stations to have a microphone? And then what do you take from that? Some of these farms are going to be managed in different ways, in different landscapes. And although we're just piggybacking on another project, it'll be interesting to see if we can come up with ways of what indices might we try to apply to these sounds that might tell us yet something additional about where these sites are located.
So now it's most important is gathering a lot of data first.
Well, in that case, yes. I mean, I think with the project we're working on, I'm really interested in trying to come up with ways of making it more appealing, I would say almost in more of an artistic sense or more of a public sense. And thinking, for example, of how can we set up a grid work of microphones and then make our sound maps but animate them so that you can see the different insects pulse on and off over the day. I'm not sure we're going to get to year length, but that would be...
You could easily do it. And that's a great thing to do with this project. You figure out how to really animate and visualize these sounds so people can see and hear what it is that you're finding out, and it just make it look really beautiful. And I mean, sonograms can be very beautiful. Often the people making them don't make them as beautiful as they could, which is something I'm very interested in. The whole visualization of sound for science should be improved because it's based on like 50-year-old technology. We can make it way cooler and at the same time show more information and also make it really attractive and grab people in with the visualization of sound.
I'd like to talk to you more about that.
Yeah.
And you're saying you are interested in this project for the public, not necessarily just for the scientific community.
Our project, I mean, we are researchers in a way, but all our research is meant to help people connect with their landscape. And so we actually haven't published a whole lot. Most of our results come out in the form of interactions with the public, and that might be in newspapers, it might be in presentations, it might be in walks that we do. And so, yes, very much I see the research as a process of trying to find ways of connecting people with the landscape in ways that are truthful. I mean, that's why you do the research, because we're not just making up where these insects are. They are where they appear to be. Hopefully we
where you heard them.
Right, or at least we'll say that much.
How does your research connect to the particular approach to science at Hawthorne Valley, connected to Goethean science and Rudolf Steiner, the stuff that the Nature Institute is doing,
right,
with Craig Holdridge?
Yeah.
Yeah, do you think it fits into that ethos?
We don't come from that background, but I think what we do is compatible in the sense that we're not, it's very much observational science. And so it's sort of trying to say, so what's out there? What can we learn from that? And it's less trying to test preconceived theories about how the world might work. So in that sense, I think it's compatible. I would put it that way.
And what is
that
the
I respect great very much.
What is the collaboration with Hawthorne Valley? Is it you just have a space or
we're part of Hawthorne Valley. So the Hawthorne Valley Farmscape Ecology Program, Hawthorne Valley is one educational nonprofit and we're a branch of that.
So it's a farm that has a research division.
Yeah, right? Ecology division is a big word,
right.
And it can, if the public wants to be involved in this or help with this, is there a way, or are you interested in hearing from other farmers, or?
If there was a farmer who was particularly interested, I would be curious in hearing from them. I think we're at the stage now where I have this little green box on the desk, which is our prototype Raspberry Pi. This was designed by Julius Mady, and he's a real electronics guru, certainly compared to me. And it's a little pre-programmable remote recorder that you can put out in the field. And the idea is to do 50 or 100 of these and put them out and sequence them so that they set off the recordings every 5 minutes or whatever and record for 50 seconds. And so once we're now at the stage, okay, how can we do that? The other thing we have to figure out is, all right, how do we process the data most efficiently? So even though Dylan might want to spend another 5,000 hours going through sonograms, we're working with the people a little bit in the bioacoustics lab at Cornell, and they have a program called Raven, which is software for analyzing bird calls. And so we're going out there in November to see if they can help us automate some of this.
Make it from, tweak the software a bit so it goes from bird calls to insects?
Well, it's already a generalized software, so that was the software we were using. But we were doing a lot of repetitive steps in that and sort of trying to pick out what the peak sounds were in this. And I'm sure there are ways.
There's a whole literature of automated sound recognition stuff that all these people are doing all over the world. Mm-hmm. Like there's a lot of people have the same problem. And so there's quite a lot of software out there people are trying to work out.
So you
should be able to find some assistance.
And are there other ways you need help from the public or want to interact with the public? Or you're looking for more outreach opportunities? Or
Eventually. I mean, at this point, we're still trying to. I think we are going to have to, this is a do-it-yourself kit. And I know one thing we're going to have to do is probably have a blitz for putting together 50 or 100 of these once we get the pieces together. So that might be something where we have a little midnight soldering party or something like that. And then, I think one thing that we would perhaps want to look for maybe in a year or something like that would be a venue where we could set these out, and I'm thinking of some sort of an educational place, where one could set these out and have them have some way the images playing but the sound also playing, so that when somebody was walking through this landscape they could get an idea over time how that soundscape that they're looking at that moment changed. So something, some sort of a collaboration with an institution that might be interested in that would be good. We're not at that stage yet, but I think it would be something we would hope to work for towards.
And anybody else?
Should say she's the only musician amongst the three of us. So. I don't know.
What was your reaction to the what you've learned so far?
I mean, before this, I really didn't know anything about how you can use sounds of insects to learn things about the landscape. So I think it's really interesting.
Did it sound to you to have musical qualities and the sounds that you were intently listening to? I guess you've probably listened to insects your whole life, but
to be honest, I haven't listened too much to them either. But I did today listen to your Radiolab podcast, where you played a bunch of different insect sounds and how they interact with each other and how they sound all together and how they sound individually. So I can definitely see the musical quality in that.
What's your instrument?
Piano.
Have you listened to Bartok's pieces based on insect sounds?
I have not listened to them
the
based
night
on insect
music,
sounds.
It's pretty interesting. And he was also an entomologist. He would go out and collect bugs. And he
I didn't know that.
Entomology papers and And you can see, you can hear in this piece, once you read this one musicologist who wrote about this, you can, he really knew what he was doing. Like, he knew about very specific insect sounds and put them into piano music.
That's interesting. Yeah, yeah, I've heard Bartok, but I didn't know
that. Yeah.
Didn't know that about
it. It would seem like there'd be more composers that would be kind of influenced by insect sounds, because they just do sound so orchestral when you're hearing the waves of like one insect and then another, and the mower, like you say, comes in and then they change sounds.
I think there are others, you know. And of course, I think electronic music really comes from insect sounds. That's where we got interested in it, from bugs. Otherwise, we wouldn't have liked electronic sounds, because they really sound like bugs, and we evolved in a world of insect noises. But this may be a strange view that I have.
You kind
Although no one's specifically disagreed with me on this. They mostly said, what are you talking about?
The idea, I guess, is wrong. Music is, all music is sort of based on sounds that humans already hear and kind of re-amplify.
Well, just certain kinds of sounds really, you know, are so insect-like, that are electronic and, you know, some people, you play them insect sounds, if they're steeped in a world of electronic music, they just imagine it's electronic music rather than a bug. You know, and then when you tell them, they think, what?
So you guys are currently at Hawthorne Valley. Can the public contact you there? Is there a...
I think email would probably be easiest. And that can be... So it's FEP, as in Farmscape Ecology Program, at hawthornevalleyfarm.org. That's all one word, and there's an E on the end of Hawthorne.
And the Farmscape Ecology Program, does it have a website on
and
part of the Hawthorne Valley website?
It's
separate.
It's linked, but it's separate. So that's HV, as in Hawthorne Valley, hvfarmscape.org.
And are there some of these results there, or sonograms, or what?
I have to go and look.
It's online somewhere.
Yeah, it is online.
If you Google it.
It is online.
Anything else that we left out that you really is important to mention? Or we should mention David Rothenberg has a show coming up at High Low in Catskill November 4th with Matt Bua. It's called Bug Music?
I think it is. Matt's been designing these cool posters for it, so he knows what it's called.
And you're going to perform?
I'm going to play all this stuff. We're going to play insect sounds and whale sounds. And Matt and I were traveling around the Arctic and 2009 recording Ice and with a bunch of crazy artists, so we might mix that in there.
All right, so that's November 4th at High Low, and anytime at Hawthorne Valley, Conrad Vispo.
We have the first Thursday of every month is an open house from 6 to 8, and anybody can stop by who wants to and can certainly talk more about this or show people. And then we have food, but nobody has to bring anything. We can just show up.
So that would be November 2nd, since November 4th is a Saturday. November 2nd was the Thursday.
I'll take your word for it.
6 to 8 p.m., you said?
6 to 8 p.m. at the Creek House at Hawthorne Valley. So if you go onto our website and follow the directions for how to visit us, that's where it is.
All right. Well, thank you today, Conrad Vispo, Dylan Sapalski, Julia Meyer, and David Rothenberg for being here.